Everything you have to know about dangerous genetically modified foods by international best-selling author and filmmaker Jeffrey M. Smith. Mr. Smith is the executive director of the Institute for Responsible Technology and the leading spokesperson on the health dangers of genetically modified organisms. His first book, Seeds of Deception, became the world's best-selling and number one rated book on GMOs. His second, Genetic Roulette, is the authoritative work that presents irrefutable evidence that genetically modified foods are harmful. Former UK Environment Minister Michael Meacher says the revelations in Genetic Roulette may change the global course of events this century. And he describes Jeffrey Smith as one of the great campaigners of our age. Mr. Smith has counseled world leaders from every continent and has been quoted by hundreds of media outlets, including the New York Times, Washington Post, BBC World Service, Nature, New Scientist, and Time Magazine. The following keynote speech took place at the Weston A. Price Foundation Conference in November 2008.
Please join me in welcoming Jeffrey Smith.
Thank you, Sally, and all of Weston A. Price Foundation. What a magnificent environment you give us to have fun in. Thank you so much. We are all activists. How many people consider themselves foodies? Yes, yes. All right, here's a loaded question. How many people have convinced several others to change their diet? Over 50? Over 1,000? Yes. We are, you know, the seed crystal. In nature, there's the seed crystal that changes the entire structure of the organism or organization. And I'll tell you, with the genetically engineered foods, the seed crystal is planted and it's moving. We have a phenomenal opportunity over the next 14, 15 months to kick GMOs out of the food supply. Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I know from whence I speak. Genetically engineered bovine growth hormone, remember that? Well, it will soon be history. Yes. In March of this year, Walmart said no more RBGH in our milk. Starbucks, Kroger's, Publix, at least 40 of the top 100 dairies so far. So what happened? The seed crystals at work. It turns out, others call it tipping point. A small percentage of consumers changing brand choices based on information, all of a sudden using a product becomes a marketing liability, and it moves the market. So if you look at the actual New York Times reports and the Washington Post and the Boston Globe, they talk about tipping point. They talk about explosion in the industry. How did this arise? Well, it turns out a few of us did it on purpose. It was no accident. We simply had to explain, oh yeah, that milk, the one with more pus. Oh, and more antibiotics, and more bovine growth hormone, and more IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1. You know, the stuff where if it's in high levels in your blood, it increases cancer and incidence of fraternal twins. Oh, that milk. You want that milk? So we started spreading it around, writing about it in books, giving PowerPoint presentations, having postcards go to different dairies, and the tipping point was reached about 2.5 years ago. Tillamook, the largest second largest cheese chunk producer in the United States, went RBGH free, and then it was like the domino effect, and we're still watching it. And 3 weeks ago, Monsanto finalized its sale of its bovine growth hormone to Elanco, Eli Lilly's veterinarian division, because Monsanto realized the days of bovine growth hormone are over. Yeah. Let's give us some. All right. So we've got the formula. We know that we can convince a small percentage of consumers to change their brands, and the tipping point happens. So what about genetically engineered foods? What is going to cause Kraft or Nestle's or Hershey's to hold on to its genetically engineered corn? Very little. There's no consumer benefit. Not a single one. Not like trans fats, which gives you something, and aspartame, which theoretically gives you something and takes a lot away. There's no consumer benefit to GMOs. You can change to non-GMO without even changing the formula for your product. Just switch to the non-GM corn, the non-GM soy. So if we get about, let's say, 5% of U.S. consumers, 15 million people, avoiding brands that contain genetically engineered foods, I think that's more than we need to get Kraft and Hershey's and Nestle's and McDonald's and others to switch to non-GM, because they'll see a reduction in their market share, they'll see a trend, and they'll simply tell their supply chain, use the non-GM varieties. You know, when the tipping point was hit in Europe in April of 1999, within 1 week, virtually the entire food supply in Europe, all the major manufacturers committed to remove GM ingredients for Europe. But those same companies feed us GMOs because in the United States, we haven't hit the tipping point. And part of the reason we haven't hit the tipping point is that people don't really understand what products are GM, what products are genetically modified. There's no labeling here. And CBS New York Times poll this year said that if GMOs were labeled, 53% of Americans would not eat them. If 1 in 10 of those, if 9 out of 10 of those people were lying, it's still enough to hit the tipping point. So we just need to give the information about which products are GM and which products are non-GM. And add a little bit of motivation by describing how eating a genetically engineered corn chip might turn your intestinal flora into living pesticide factories. So, we've created the Campaign for Healthier Eating in America, whose slogan is, healthy eating starts with no GMOs. So all you foodies out there, this is your mantra this year coming. So you have all these things to give to all of your friends and your devotees and your patients. And you want to talk about raw milk and you want to talk about soy. But healthy eating starts with no GMOs. Because by the end of next year, we expect to hit the tipping point. And we're going to do it here. Now, we have created non-GMO education centers, and on the top of that are non-GMO shopping guides, which list the brands that are non-GM and list samples of products that are GM, and also describes how you can evaluate a product by reading the ingredients and looking at the packaging to determine if it's GM or not. So we are giving. We're not waiting for the government to label. We'll do it ourselves. And we're going to put these non-GMO, we are already putting these non-GMO education centers in natural food stores around the country. So if you meet me after the talk over there, you all get your free non-GMO shopping guide. You all get your health risks brochure, which encourages you to use the shopping guide. For those of you that are doctors, we have a package for your patients. And we're putting it out through many different organizations in electronic form, in physical form. We expect to distribute the shopping guide totally in the tens of millions next year. So we are going to do what people have been sort of, we've been whining about this for 12 years, waiting for the government to do it for us. What a waste of life. What a waste of life. I'll tell you, by the way, Obama says he's going to label genetically engineered foods. He says that. Let's hear it. Yeah. I'm not going to wait, though. How do we avoid GMOs? Four ways. By organic, by products that are that say non-GMO, by products listed on a non-GMO shopping guide, or avoid the at-risk ingredients. Now, what are the at-risk ingredients? For the crops, there are four major GM crops: soy, corn, cotton, and canola. Soy, corn, cotton, and canola. Everyone. Soy, corn, cotton, and canola. Now, what are vegetable oils made out of generally? Soy, corn, cotton, and canola. Another excuse to avoid vegetable oils. Okay, minor food crops. Hawaiian papaya, zucchini, crookneck squash. A tiny percentage of the GM crops out there. And also, unfortunately, starting this year, the sugar supply in the United States will be genetically engineered from sugar beets. So this is the first new crop introduced in a long time, so we have to move quickly. We don't have time to waste. Okay, everyone raise your hand. Everyone raise your hand. Thank you all for volunteering to do more on the GMO issue, and you will know how to do it within an hour, and it'll be easy and fun and successful. Remember RBGH? Well, your children won't. All right. So the reason we're here is due to the glories of the Food and Drug Administration. Based on a single sentence, GMOs have flooded the market. The sentence in the policy says the agency's not aware of any information showing that the foods created by these new methods differ from other foods in any meaningful or uniform way. Now, it's obviously not true. In fact, documents made public from a lawsuit proved that that sentence was a lie. But on the basis of that sentence, the FDA said no testing was necessary. The FDA said if the companies that produce the biotech foods believe they are safe, I guess it's coming, they can put it on the market without even telling the FDA. But a friend of mine sued the FDA. 44,000 internal memos became public. And it turned out that the overwhelming consensus among the FDA's own scientists were that GMOs might create allergies, toxins, new diseases, and nutritional problems. They had urged their superiors to require long-term studies. But every time the policy came back, the new draft of the policy, the concerns of the scientists were systematically extracted and removed and ignored. One scientist wrote in a memo, "What's become of this document? It's basically a political document. There's no science in it. It does not address the unpredicted side effects." So who overruled the scientists? The person in charge of policy at the FDA, Michael Taylor, Monsanto's former attorney, and later Monsanto's vice president. He had worked with Monsanto and a group of biotech companies before working at the FDA to create the ideal regulatory system for the companies and then evidently implemented it himself. This was in 1992 and his policy still stands. So the companies do participate in a voluntary consultation process, technically called a meaningless exercise, where they bring their conclusions, not the raw feeding study data, not real science, their conclusions, and the FDA responds with a letter which says, "You believe your foods are safe." It never says the FDA says the foods are safe. It says, You understand it's your responsibility to evaluate your foods, and we understand that you've evaluated them as safe. No further questions. And that is our glorious assessment system of genetically engineered foods. Now, one food, one GM food, the Flavor Saver tomato, was the only genetically engineered crop, the first one, to ever go through a thorough, systematic feeding study that was turned over to the FDA. They did a rat study with the tomato, and the rats refused to eat the tomato. Let's hear it for those rats! Yeah! All right. If you ever want to market rat-proof tomatoes, you know where to go. It turns out farmers and scientists and reporters from all over North America say that when given a choice, many animals chose to avoid eating GMOs. Pigs, cows, geese, elk, squirrels, deer, raccoons, mice, and rats. In fact, in my book, Seeds of Deception, before each chapter, I write a little vignette, The Wisdom of the Animals, with another description. And someone evidently read that about squirrels, where they put corn on the cob out for squirrels, and the squirrels wouldn't eat the BT corn. So he wanted to do this experiment and see if it worked for the squirrels around his house. So he bought a couple of bags of corn, BT corn that produces its own pesticide, and natural corn. And he put it in the garage, waiting for the winter to feed the squirrels. And he forgot. And in the spring, he discovered the bags, and the mice had done the experiment for him. The mice had broken into the non-GM corn and finished every kernel and never touched the BT corn. So it's our job to get humans up to the level of animals. Are you up for it? Yeah? Now, they force-fed the rats, and 7 of 20 developed stomach lesions, and 7 of 40 died within 2 weeks. Now, in the UK, they decided, let's do long-term feeding studies and prove to the skeptical public that GMOs were safe. So they put out a request for a proposal to create the testing protocol. They got 28 different applications, and they gave the $3 million grant to Dr. Arpad Pusztai, the world's leading expert in his field. How many people have heard of Dr. Arpad Pusztai? All right. So I write all about him in the first chapter of my book. And by the way, this book is Seeds of Deception, is written in story format, and the whole first chapter is Arpad Pusztai's story. And it's hard to put down. That's why I wrote it, because it's, I mean, I might say that's true. I know this because someone did a master's thesis on the impact of my book on the passage of the first state regulation on GMOs. It was in Vermont. And he interviewed a bunch of representatives, and they said, normally, books don't influence policymakers because they're too thick, we don't have time. But when I started reading it, I couldn't put it down. And someone said the book spread like wildfire and was the basis for every conversation on GMOs in the State House once it arrived. So here's the first activist tip. If you choose to use this in your lending library, then what you say is, just read the first chapter. And that's usually all it needs. And that first chapter is a kind of a microcosm, as we'll see in a minute, of what's going on with GMOs. Because Dr. Pusztai, he worked with a team from 3 different institutes, including his own very prestigious institute, 20 or 30 scientists, and he created a protocol that was going to be used as the EU testing protocol for GMOs. And what he did was, he created a potato engineered to produce an insecticide. Took a gene from a snowdrop plant, put it into the potato, and as part of the protocol, they fed it to rats along with a complete and balanced diet. Another group of rats were fed natural potatoes, and a third group were fed natural potatoes spiked with the same insecticide that the genetically engineered potatoes were producing. So GM potatoes, natural potatoes, natural potatoes with the insecticide. Only the GM group got sick. What was the cause of the problem? What caused the potentially precancerous cell growth in the digestive tract, the smaller brains, livers, and testicles, the atrophy of the liver and the damaged immune system. What caused the intestinal walls on the rats on the right side of the photo to have such prolific cell growth, or the stomach lining to look about double the size? It was not the insecticide. It was somehow the process of genetically engineering the potato. Now, Dr. Pusztai went public with his concerns, was a hero for about 2 days at his prestigious institute, and then two phone calls were allegedly placed from the UK Prime Minister's office to the director of the institute. The next day, Dr. Pusztai was fired from his job after 35 years, silenced with threats of a lawsuit. His 20-member research team was disbanded. They never implemented the long-term safety testing protocols. Instead, they mounted a campaign to trash his reputation. He's since got the data back. It's published in The Lancet. And it implicates the process of genetic engineering as very dangerous. These problems occurred in 10 days. Now, one thing that was interesting about the potatoes was that they would have passed the assessments used around the world, even where they're required in the EU. The assessments done by industry are so poor, so superficial, that the potatoes would have made it to market. But the crops that are already on the market have never been tested in the ways for these things that the potatoes were tested for. So they may be creating the same problems because they were created from the same process. So this is the first possible cause of problems. The very process itself of genetically engineering a crop causes massive collateral damage and unpredicted side effects. So what is the process? Let's say you want to take corn and turn it into a registered pesticide. So you take a gene from soil bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT. How many people use BT on their garden or farm? It's used by organic gardeners. It's a natural pesticide. But they take the gene out of that pesticide, they make changes in it so that it'll work in crops. But they have to figure out a way to turn it on, because normally genes are self-regulating based on the needs of the cell. But they're ignoring the needs of the cell, so they put in a viral promoter, an on switch, that turns on that gene 24/7 around the clock to pump out that BT toxin. They put an end switch at the very end, stop signal, saying to the cell, stop reading, the gene ends here. Then they make millions of copies of that gene construct and put it into a gun. And they shoot that gun into millions of cells, hoping that some of the genes make it into the DNA of some of those cells. You can't tell where it ends up. You can't even tell by looking at it if it got in there. So they need to figure out a way to figure out which one of the cells have the genes functioning. So before they make millions of copies, they add another gene into the gene construct. It's called an antibiotic-resistant marker gene. Its job is to produce a protein that renders the cell invincible to a normally deadly antibiotic. So after they shoot the genes into the cell, they add antibiotics, killing almost all of the cells except the very few that have the gene construct functioning inside the DNA, because that has rendered the cell invincible to that antibiotic. Then they take those cells and they clone them into the corn plant that produces the BT toxin. So it's a lot of things, but it's not natural. It's not sex. And what it does is it causes unexpected changes in the DNA. 2 to 4% of the DNA is different as a result of the process of insertion and the cloning. And most of that is mutations, hundreds or thousands of mutations up and down the DNA. Genes can also be deleted, permanently turned off, permanently turned on. And on top of that, the single insertion causes a holistic response where as much as 5% of the genes, the natural functioning genes in the plant, change. They change the levels of expression of the proteins they're producing. So we're talking about massive collateral damage. When you change the DNA, you change the RNA, which the DNA creates, you change the proteins interact to create all these natural compounds which give the special qualities to a plant. Many of them can be increased, decreased, there could be new ones. And we don't test for them. They don't test for them. They test for a small handful of known nutrients, maybe one or two known toxins, and put it on the market, knowing that there may be hundreds of different compounds that have changed levels of expression or are new. So one example that was found accidentally was that soy and corn have higher levels of lignin after being genetically engineered. It's the woody component in trees and plants. But the metabolic pathway that produces lignin produces rotenone also, which is a known plant pesticide, which may be a cause of Parkinson's disease. So if it creates more lignin, it might create more rotenone, it might create more Parkinson's disease, but we don't know it. It's just one of a myriad of things that can change as a result of the process. It is a genetic roulette. The second cause of problems is that the protein that they intend to be produced in the plant. What happens is, just to review the basic science, they put a gene into the plant so that the gene produces a protein and the protein has a trait that they consider desirable. So there are, that protein may be harmful. Now there are two primary traits. About 80% of all crops are designed not to die when sprayed with a particular herbicide. So here's how that worked. Monsanto found bacteria surviving in a chemical waste dump in the presence of the normally deadly Roundup, their herbicide. And they said, let's put it in the food supply. So they took the gene that produced the Roundup ready protein, allowing the bacteria to survive, and they put that gene into soy, corn, cotton, canola, and now sugar beets, so that when you spray the field with Roundup, you just kill all the other plant biodiversity in the field, not the Roundup-ready crops. About the other 20% of the crops produce their own pesticide, BT. Then there's a tiny percentage, those papaya, zucchini, and crookneck squash, that have virus-resistant proteins. Now, viral proteins, it turns out, there's more than 100 studies that show that viral proteins can suppress the defense mechanism against viral infection. And they may also be toxic, interfering with things like the cell cycle, which might be cancerous. So the protein itself that's intended to be put into the product, in the case of these papaya, zucchini, and crookneck squash, might theoretically be causing us to be more susceptible to viral infection and cancer or other diseases. Now let's take a look at the BT toxin and see if that has a problem. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, which registers the crops as official pesticides, the BT is not a problem because it has a history of safe use among farmers, among forestry, organic farmers. They say the BT toxin is destroyed during digestion and is completely benign to mammals anyway because we don't even have receptor cells for it. It would just pass through our system if it weren't destroyed during digestion. Now, this is the assumption that allowed them to approve BT crops without testing them. However, the assumptions about the basic natural BT are false. About 500 people in North America got allergic type reactions when they were sprayed with BT when it was used for gypsy moth infestation. When they took BT and they fed it to mice, the mice developed an immune response as powerful as if they had been fed cholera toxin. Some developed a damaged intestines. So it survives digestion, it does interact with mammals, and it does affect humans in its natural state. But the BT that's produced in crops is thousands of times more concentrated than the spray form. It's designed to be more toxic, than the spray form, and it has properties of a known allergen. So now what we're seeing in India are hundreds, maybe thousands of workers who touch the BT cotton are reporting allergic reactions. The same allergic reactions as those that were reported by the 500 people in North America. Sneezing, runny nose, watery red eyes, itching, burning, inflammation, swelling, skin. Some had fever, some went to the hospital. Here's a picture that I received last week from a different region in India than the particular study I just pointed to. And the person said that in the 2 to 3 years since the BT cotton, many, many people have had itching all over their bodies, eruptions, wounds, and discoloration. On October 26th of this year, the Sunday India newspaper reported that hospital records show that victims of itching have increased massively this year, and all of them are related to BT cotton farming. A pharmacy manager said almost every cotton worker from this village suffers from itching. Not a day passes by without a few of them coming to purchase medicines for it. In 2006, it was reported that when they let sheep graze on the cotton plants after harvest, within 5 to 7 days, one out of every four sheep died. In February of this year, some colleagues in India did a little study. They took 9 sheep. They let 3 of them graze on genetically engineered Bolgard 1, 3 of them on genetically engineered Bolgard 2, and 3 of them on natural cotton plants. This was after harvest. They noted a progression of symptoms just among the groups fed GM. First of all, they reduced their food intake. And there was swelling lips, frothy salivation, nasal discharge, then bulging of the heads, then a slight fever, and then between day 25 and 30, there was 100% mortality among the 6 animals fed BT plants. Those 3 that were fed non-BT had no symptoms. About 10 days ago, I received an email from someone in India about buffaloes and cows in an area northwest of Delhi. Turns out the buffaloes most refused to eat BT cotton and seed and oil cake. Those that did had prolapsed uteruses, many of them premature deliveries, most. Abortions became very common. The age of conception advanced up to 2 years. Milk is so important from these buffaloes, and yet there was a reduction in the milk supply and the fat content and the taste quality. There were skin problems and lots of deaths among both adult and calves. So one thing that I do is I always consider this area my responsibility, because food is all of our responsibility. And I've noted that the reason why GMOs are on the market is because systematically governments and individuals and companies have done just the opposite. They've said, someone else's responsibility. You ask a business, well, what about your GMOs? The FDA has said it's safe. You ask the FDA, they say, oh, no, Monsanto has said it's safe. I talked to a Monsanto scientist, a former Monsanto scientist this year, about RBGH. He said, yeah, I knew 3 scientists who were doing safety studies on RBGH for Monsanto, and all of them switched to organic milk. So they also said, it's not our responsibility. Someone else will make the decision. We won't eat it. So I look at this and say, no. What can I do? So I emailed this person that sent it to me and said, maybe we can help fund some video of what's going on and do an investigation. So yesterday we secured funding. We didn't have any money. We were a poor organization, but I put it out there. And then I found a funder yesterday, and we're going to send 2 veterinarians and a reporter and a film crew to leave next week.
I went to one village in Andhra Pradesh, and for 7 or 8 years, they allowed their buffalo to graze on cotton plants after harvest. But on January 3rd of last year, they allowed their animals to graze on BT cotton for the first time. And they grazed for 1 day. The next day, they were either unconscious or unable to move, and the vets couldn't revive them. After 3 days, they were all dead, all 13. They also told me that their 26 sheep and goats had died. The post-mortem showed holes in the lungs, the liver was darker, flattened, and dry, and there was undigested food in the rumen. The rumen is like the early stomach, which it usually breaks down the cellulose through microorganisms. So it raised the question, does BT toxin kill the rumen bacteria?
Now, the cotton problems, I talk a lot about health dangers, and that's strategic. Because if I want people to avoid eating GMOs, many people can hate Monsanto, many people can be concerned about the environmental impacts, the patenting of life, the concentration of the ownership of farming, all these terrible problems associated with GMOs. But to get people to change lifelong eating habits and to switch brands, it's more about the health. But there are other things about GMOs that are very, very dangerous. In fact, the environmental impact may be far worse than the health impact. Why? Because the genetic pollution we're putting into the environment is self-propagating. The genes we put into the gene pool, that genetic pollution, can outlast the effects of global warming and nuclear waste. We are altering our biosphere, maybe irreversibly. We don't have a technology today to fully clean it up. We can reduce it dramatically, but today we cannot pull the contamination of GM corn out of the indigenous corn varieties in Mexico. They want to introduce, in 2 years, genetically engineered insects. They want to introduce genetically engineered salmon. Imagine trying to do a recall. Now, one of the aspects of GMOs is that we have all these unpredicted side effects for health, but there's unpredicted side effects in the environment. When they planted this BT cotton, Monsanto bought the seed companies in India and pushed the BT cotton in certain areas, in some cases removing the availability of non-BT seed. They had spiritual leaders push their cotton, Bollywood actors push their cotton. And they convinced hundreds of thousands of farmers to take out loans to invest in the cotton and the agricultural chemicals that would allow them to become rich. And in many cases, the cotton failed. And there has been farmer suicides. On November 3rd, the Daily Mail in the UK gave us an idea of how many farmer suicides. 125,000. So our food supply is under attack. Our farmers are under attack. This is something that needs to be handled immediately. To finish up about BT, 12 cows died on a German farm after being fed exclusively a certain variety of BT corn. About 25 farmers in the Midwest say that their pigs or cows became sterile from varieties of BT corn. In the Philippines, a village of about 100 people developed skin, respiratory, and intestinal reactions and fever while breathing in the BT pollen during the time of pollination. They took the same seeds and planted them in 4 more villages. The same symptoms returned in all 4 villages during the time of pollination. Though the symptoms were different than the cotton farmers. Some of them were the same, but they also had headache, stomach ache, dizziness, diarrhea, vomiting, weakness, and numbness. And there were deaths among horses, water buffaloes, and chickens, and 5 unexplained human deaths. Even Monsanto's own study made public from a lawsuit showed that when rats ate their BT corn variety, they had indicators for liver and kidney toxicity and indicators for blood pressure problems, allergies, infections, or disease, high blood sugar, and anemia.
When they fed mice BT corn, they had multiple immune responses, just like the mice who were fed the BT toxin alone. And this that was a government study in Italy, released last year. An Austrian study released last year showed that the more corn they fed the mice, the fewer babies were born and the smaller the babies were.
So these problems, they may be the result of massive collateral damage, but it also may be simply the BT toxin itself, which is intended to be produced inside our food. So that's the second potential problem, and that you have the massive collateral damage is the one. You have the toxin itself, or the protein itself may be the other. The third is that the protein that you produce inside the crop may end up being very different than the one that you intend. Here's a little science, very simple. You have a little computer program called the genetic code in the gene that you insert. The gene is called the transgene. And that code determines the RNA, and that code, every three of them, determine which amino acid is being used to create the protein. And the protein, the amino acids line up, they fold into a protein. Now, in the process of inserting the gene, you can often mess up that sequence. It can mutate or truncate. One of Monsanto's BT corn varieties, 30% of it was just lopped off, and it creates a protein that was different. Another one has a mutation inside it, which could produce a protein that's different. Now, another set of studies, this is very interesting. In Europe, a set of laboratories did an analysis. They actually tested the genes sequence and the nearby regions. And in every single case out of six popular GM varieties, the sequence that they found in the plants was different than that which was registered by the company. And in some cases, one lab found a different sequence than another lab in the same variety. This suggests that the sequence is unstable and can rearrange over time. So how can you evaluate its safety today if it morphs and mutates tomorrow? Now, just suppose that the sequence goes in as you want it to, and that's what they suppose. The cell can read it differently or produce many proteins from the same gene. Now, just suppose, and they do, that it produces the amino acid sequence that you're looking for, you can still be messed up because it can fold differently. And misfolded proteins are very dangerous. Prions associated with mad cow disease. There's amyloid fibrils associated with Alzheimer's, misfolded proteins. Or you might have different molecules attached to the protein, which can turn a harmless protein into a deadly one. And that appears to be what has happened to peas that were genetically engineered in Australia to produce an insecticide. They took genes from kidney beans that naturally produce an insecticide, and they put it into peas. Now, the peas had already passed all of the tests necessary to get on the market anywhere in the world. But these developers decided to do a test that had never before been done on GM food crops. They decided to do an immunological test with mice. They took the protein from the peas and they tested it, from the kidney beans in its natural state, exposed it to mice, and the mice were fine. Then they took the identical protein. In this case, they did test the amino acids. It was exactly the same. They took the protein and they fed it to mice, and they exposed it to mice in a variety of ways, and in every single case, the mice had an inflammatory reaction in the lungs, on the feet, suggesting that the peas could create deadly anaphylactic shock in human beings. So they canceled the commercialization of the peas, which would have been exported to India for their food supply. Now, the scientists, and I spoke to three of them who had done this study, one of them said, we're very concerned and confused as to why the identical protein would act so differently in completely in closely related species. So they did another test, which is almost never done on, by GM crop developers, and they found that the molecules that had attached to the protein, the sugar molecules, called glycosylation, which is known to have potentially allergenic properties, that the shape, that the pattern had changed slightly. And they said, ah, this subtle change in the sugars is probably why the harmless protein had become a potentially deadly one. However, those peas could have made it to market without those tests. So when Monsanto's spokesperson in Europe was asked to comment on the cancellation of the peas in Australia, he said, this shows that the regulatory system works. He never mentioned that none of his products had ever been tested in the same way, and that not only was his products, you see, they were surprised that the protein had changed in such closely related species. But Monsanto takes genes from different kingdoms, from bacteria, from viruses, and put it into plants, and expects it to act the same, and puts it on the market without testing it before we eat it. The fourth possible problem is that there are more herbicide residues on these herbicide-tolerant crops. So in the first 9 years of herbicide-tolerant crops, there was an increase of 138 million pounds of herbicide in the United States. And it's accelerating because of the development of herbicide-tolerant weeds that no longer respond to the same amount of Roundup or to Roundup at all. So in the next 2 years, there was an additional 120 million pound increase, and in 1 year, a 38% increase recently. But now farmers are using the more toxic compounds like 2,4-D, which is up 237% in 2 years. With increased herbicide, you end up with an increased fungus, Fusarium, which creates mycotoxins, a decrease in trace minerals, and a possible impact on gut bacteria because these herbicides are antibacterial and they're at higher concentrations, so they can mess up our gut bacteria. Chickens fed Liberty Link herbicide-tolerant corn died at twice the rate, but this was an industry-funded study designed so poorly that even a doubling of the death rate was statistically insignificant. The fifth possible problem is that genes might transfer into our gut bacteria or into our own DNA. Now, this was of grave concern to the FDA scientists reviewing the first Flavor Saver tomato. The Flavor Saver tomato uses an antibiotic-resistant marker gene. We discussed that before. The Division of Anti-Infective Drugs wrote a memo complaining about this tomato. And they said, in all capital letters, it would be a serious health hazard to introduce a gene that codes for antibiotic resistance into the intestinal flora of the general population. Can anyone guess why? They were concerned that this antibiotic-resistant marker gene might transfer to pathogenic bacteria, allowing the bacteria to be invincible to one or more antibiotics. But the biotech industry and the political appointees at the FDA said, not to worry. Genes are destroyed during digestion. Transfer is impossible. Well, they finally tested this in a study published in 2004, the only human feeding study ever conducted on genetically engineered foods. It was a brilliant study. They took seven human volunteers who had colostomy bags. They had their lower intestines removed. Not for the study. They fed them a soy burger and a soy milkshake, genetically engineered. They looked in the colostomy bag and were surprised to find how much intact genetically engineered soy DNA had survived passage through the stomach and small intestine. It was supposed to be destroyed, and not all of it was. But in three of the seven volunteers, before they were fed the soy burger and soy milkshake, the scientists found inside the DNA of the gut bacteria the gene that Monsanto scientists had found in the chemical waste dump that they had put into soybeans, that had been put into the food supply, that had somehow in the past been eaten by these three people from England and had integrated into the DNA, along with that promoter, that on switch, and it was functioning. They had Roundup Ready gut bacteria, unkillable with Roundup herbicide. So this means that long after we stop eating genetically engineered foods, we might have little hitchhikers that have left the food and joined us in our internal community to bless us with whatever. Now, what can transfer? The promoter did transfer, according to this study, and that promoter is a very aggressive on switch made from a virus. And they discovered that on switch can turn on genes, not just the gene to which it's attached, but other genes, natural genes, permanently at high volume. So if that promoter transfers to gut bacteria, it might overproduce an allergen, a toxin, a carcinogen, or something good. We don't know. It's a genetic roulette. The antibiotic-resistant marker gene might transfer, causing super diseases. The Roundup Ready gene did transfer, and that has properties of a known allergen. According to the WHO, if that particular property is there, they should never commercialize the GM crop because it might cause allergic reactions. But that's a recommendation, and it's not enforced. And that's the protein that's produced inside of us continuously. The Liberty Link gene, another herbicide-tolerant gene, it might have the capacity of turning non-toxic residues in Liberty Link crops into herbicide inside of us. The BT gene might transfer. So this is where I meant eating a genetically engineered corn chip might transform your intestinal flora into living pesticide factories, possibly for the rest of our lives. And the viral gene might transfer, creating viral proteins that cause a permanent suppression of our viral defenses or toxic effects. We don't know. These have not been tested. I want to emphasize, the only one that's been tested is Roundup Ready. The rest is theoretical. Now, if I stop the discussion here at a general scientific talk with probiotic scientists ready in the audience to pounce, during the Q&A, they would assure the audience that I was a fearmonger because we've been eating DNA for centuries and thousands of years, and if gene transfer were a problem, we would be green like plants, we'd have photosynthesis. It's simply not a problem. And this is their intellectual, scientific argument as to why we shouldn't be concerned about gene transfer. I love when they do that. It's such a setup. It's like a slow motion softball waiting for me to hit it out of the park. You see, it turns out plant genes don't readily transfer to bacteria in our gut. Bacteria genes transfer all the time. And one of the main reasons why they do is because there's similarity in the sequence. But the sequence in plant genes is substantially different and therefore very unlikely to transfer. It's also longer, making it very unlikely to transfer. The genes that are in the soy, corn, cotton, and canola are from bacteria. They have the similarity. Second, if genes transfer from plants into bacteria, it is unlikely that they will function. The promoter, the on switch in plants, does not work in bacteria. The genes, this promoter that they put into the genes that they put into soy, corn, cotton, and canola, comes from a virus. It works in bacteria. Another point, if the plant gene transfers to bacteria, it's got something inside it called introns, little sections that get in the way, where the cell has to remove those introns and reconnect in order to produce a protein. That happens inside higher organisms. It happens inside us. It does not happen inside bacteria. So if it transferred, the bacteria would have no clue how to make a protein from it. It wouldn't work. The genes that are put into soy, corn, cotton, and canola don't have introns. So, the natural barriers that have stopped plant genes from populating our gut bacteria and functioning have been dismantled, which means we may be shuttling all of these genes from genetically engineered crops, colonizing our bacteria. Now, the big question is there a selective advantage for the bacteria to take these genes? Because if it is, then it'll live long, be fruitful, and multiply. We don't know. There's herbicide-tolerant genes in there, and we eat large amounts of herbicide on these herbicide-tolerant crops because they get sprayed by so much herbicide. And that means that there may be a selective advantage because those bacteria won't die because they're Roundup Ready gut bacteria. So we may be altering that such that precious area of our health and digestion, the gut bacteria, altering it throughout North America. Not from the canola oil or the cottonseed oil, because that doesn't have DNA, but from the corn on the cob, the corn chips, the other soy products that contain the DNA. So this is very serious. It also is possible that the genes might transfer to our own DNA, wreaking havoc in our own cells. Now, I want to run through GM soy as well. We've pounded on the BT. Let's take a look at the soy problems. Soon after GM soy was introduced to the UK, soy allergies skyrocketed by 50%. No follow-up study was done. In a small study with skin prick tests, they found one person had a positive reaction to GM soy, but not to non-GM soy, suggesting a unique allergenic profile. Actually, there are many reasons why GM soy might be more allergenic. First of all, it has more herbicide residues. They may cause problems. Second, there's a known allergen in soy called trypsin inhibitor, where in Monsanto's own study, conveniently left out of the publication but discovered later, in cooked GM soy, it was as much as 7 times higher than non-GM soy. In another study, they fed GM soy to mice, and the enzymes in the pancreas were suppressed by as much as 77%. Now, if your protein-digesting enzymes are not functioning properly, you leave more time in the digestive system for protein to hang out and cause trouble and cause allergic reactions. So eating genetically engineered soy might increase allergic reactions to a wide variety of foods. In addition, they looked inside the GM soy and they found a new protein that was never intended, probably the result of the massive collateral damage that occurs during the process of creating the GM. And this protein was able to bind with IgE antibodies, meaning it was probably an allergen, or possibly an allergen. And as I mentioned, the protein itself, the Roundup Ready protein, has properties of a dust mite allergen. So it itself might be an allergen, and it may be continuously produced inside of us if the gene transfers. So all of those are reasons why GM soy might be increasing allergies to soy or other problems or other allergies. Now, when mice and rabbits were fed Roundup Ready soy, they had altered cells, enzymes, or gene expression in livers, kidneys, pancreases, and hearts. Here's mice livers. That's the nuclei. You'll see on the right, the membrane around the nuclei is more rough, not as smooth. Inside the nuclei is the nucleoli. You'll see differences there as well in the GM-fed group on the right. Rat livers on the right also show clear differences in the tissues compared to the controls that ate non-GM soy. Rats that ate GM soy, the testicles changed color. The cells changed color. For mice that were fed GM soy, there was damage and changes in the young sperm cells. Then they looked at the young embryos from those mice, and they found that there was a temporary decrease in gene expression in the embryos when the parents were fed GM soy compared to when they were fed non-GM soy. Now these rats, this picture was given to me by Dr. Irina Ermakova, a senior scientist at the Russian National Academy of Sciences. She and I were a member of a panel that presented at the EU Parliament last year. So these rats are Russian-speaking rats. And they volunteered for a soy-eating experiment. And they were fed GM soy starting 2 weeks before they conceived, and more than half of their offspring died within 3 weeks. Compared to about 1 in 10 for the mothers that were fed non-GM soy. Here's a picture of one day's death rate. You'll notice that the GM soy group was smaller. They also had a different look to them. Notice the GM soy group on the bottom. Here's a comparison of two rats the same age, 19 days. The smaller one is from the GM group. They tried to mate the offspring of the GM group, but they could not conceive. Now, this is preliminary evidence. It was reported in a conference in October 2005, and Dr. Ermakova basically said, "This is astounding research. I've repeated it 3 times. I have frozen my samples of tissues. I have no more money. Please repeat the study. Please offer money for us. We can evaluate it to see if GM soy is causing these problems." Well, as you probably guessed, it has never been repeated. She's been vilified. She's been taken off of any GM research. In fact, she told me while we had lunch at the European Parliament building, she said one of her colleagues tried to console her because she had been pressured by her director, who was pressured by his director, so they couldn't do any more GM research. So the colleague consoled her and said, "Well, maybe the GM soy will solve the overpopulation problem." Now, in the attacks on her, there is one valid point that I have to bring up that's very clear. It was a mistake in the study, I think, and that is that she never did a biochemical analysis of the feed, because it's possible that there might have been some toxins in the soy flour that she used that was the cause of these astounding results. Now, after doing it 3 times with the same feed, an interesting coincidence happened. The feed that they were using as the rat chow for all the rats in the facility changed to be GM soy based. So she couldn't do any more studies because she had no more controls. But after 2 months of all of the rats eating GM soy, she asked her colleagues, "What is the mortality rate of the rats you're using in your experiment?" It had skyrocketed to over 55%, suggesting that it is not a particular toxin in her batch, but that it is a generic problem that might be affecting the human population. Now, if GM crops are so bad, why don't we see more problems? We can take a lesson from L-tryptophan. L-tryptophan, produced by genetically engineered bacteria in the 1980s, was responsible for a deadly epidemic that killed about 100 Americans and caused 5,000 to 10,000 to fall sick. Only the brand that was genetically engineered was responsible for the deadly epidemic. It took about 4 years for them to identify that there was even an epidemic taking place, and they almost missed it. The only reason they found it was because the disease had 3 simultaneous characteristics. The first was that it was new symptoms. It stood out. Completely new disease. The second was that the symptoms were acute, forcing people to go to hospitals and to doctors. And the doctors said it was the worst pain they had ever seen in their careers. And third, it came on quickly. Now, what if all 3 characteristics had not been in place? What if it was not new? What if it was heart disease, or diabetes, or cancer, or autism? It would still be on the market. What if it was not acute? What if it was frequent colds, or memory loss? It might still be on the market. What if it didn't come on quickly? What if it took 20 years to show up? What if it took the next generation? So it begs the question, what about GM foods on the market? Might they be creating an epidemic today that's going unnoticed, that might not have all three characteristics? Might it be responsible for the doubling of food-related illnesses in the United States between 1994 and 2001? Or all the horrendous statistics we're seeing worse in the United States and Canada than overseas? We don't know because there's no post-marketing surveillance. The Canadian FDA, Health Canada, said, we're going to look at the health of Canadians and see if GMOs are positively or are negatively affecting them. This was in 2002. By 2003, they gave up, saying it's too difficult. There's no human clinical trials, no proper evaluation of all those potential changes. Approvals are based on assumptions which are largely disproved or untested. Or they're based on industry-funded studies which are designed so poorly these guys have bad science down to a science. I'd like you to rate yourself from 1 to 100. How vigilant you'll be next week. Rate yourself from 1 to 100 how vigilant you'll be at avoiding bringing GM foods into your home. 1 to 20. 20 to 40. 40 to 60. 60 to 80. 80 to 100. Now, you may have noticed a change here. This change is consistent when I speak to medical doctors, food service directors, farmers, foodies, parents. It is easy. It is easy to make changes in people's lifelong eating habits on the spot, which makes the elimination of GMOs so easy. You don't have to become a GMO expert and stand in front of a group and speak, because I've got this recorded. And I've got this in all these different variety of ways for the left brainer, the right brainer, the visual thinker, the audio person, the person with the iPod. But we do need the network. So how active do you plan to be on helping to stop this? How do we stop it? Let's compare where we are today with the plans by Monsanto. In a San Francisco biotech conference, not far from here, in January of 1999, Monsanto's consultant, Arthur Anderson Consulting, they were also Enron's consultant, birds of a feather, they described how they worked with Monsanto to develop their plans for GMOs. They asked the executives to describe their ideal future in 15 to 20 years. The Monsanto executives describe a world in which 100% of all commercial seeds in the world were genetically engineered and patented. And Anderson Consulting worked backwards from that goal to create the strategy and tactics to achieve it. A few speakers later, another biotech representative projected a 95% takeover of all commercial seeds within 5 years. By 2004. But within 3 weeks, their ideal future crashed. And here is where I will share with you the first page of Seeds of Deception. And you're going to have to buy it to get the rest. Lesson from overseas. When Susan answered the door, she was startled to see several reporters standing in front of her. More were running from their cars in her direction, and she could see other cars and TV news vans parking along her street. But you all know we can't speak about what happened. We would be sued. It's okay now, the reporter from Channel 4 television interrupted, waving a paper in front of her. They've released your husband. He can talk to us. Susan took the paper. Arpad, come here, she called to her husband. Arpad Pusztai, a distinguished-looking man in his late 60s, was already on his way. As his wife showed him the document, the reporter slipped past them into the house. But Arpad didn't notice. He was staring at the paper his wife had just handed him. He recognized the letterhead at once, the Rowett Institute, Aberdeen, Scotland. It was one of the world's leading nutritional institutes and his employer for the previous 35 years, until his sudden suspension 7 months ago. And there it was, clearly spelled out. They had released their gag order. He could speak. The document was dated that same day, February 16, 1999. In fact, less than 20 minutes before, 30 reporters had sat in the Rowett press conference listening to its director, Professor Philip James, casually mention that the restriction on Dr. Pusztai speaking to the press had been lifted. Before James had finished his sentence, the reporters leaped for the door. They jumped into their cars and headed straight to the Pusztai's house on Ashley Park North, an address most were familiar with, having virtually camped out there 7 months earlier. Now those 30 reporters with TV cameras and tape recorders were piled into the Pusztai's living room. Arpad Pusztai read the document twice. As he looked up, the reporters started asking him questions all at once. He smiled and breathed more easily than he had in a long time. He had all but given up hope. Now he finally had the chance to share what he knew about the dangers of genetically engineered foods. Within 1 week, 159 column feet of articles were written. Within a month, 750 articles. By April of 1999, using GMOs had become a marketing liability. The tipping point was achieved. Starting with Unilever, Britain's largest food manufacturer, they publicly committed to no longer use GM ingredients in their European brands. Within about 3 days, so did everyone else. That has limited the expansion of GMOs, not to 95% of all commercial seeds, but largely to four major crops with two major traits in six countries and in 2.4% of the agricultural land. We need to create the tipping point in the United States to make GMOs a marketing liability. Now, we can wait for the general population to get it. We can ask Oprah Winfrey, she could do it in 60 minutes. And I'm trying. But we don't need to convince the average junk-eating couch potato person in the United States to change their diet and to consider for the first time that food might have an effect. We have four groups in the United States that are receptive to this knowledge, that would take this information and act on it, and each one of those four groups are large enough to create the tipping point all by themselves. We have health-conscious shoppers. 28 million Americans buy organic food regularly, 54 million Americans less regularly. Now, already, more than half say they would avoid eating GMOs. More than half the general population say they would avoid eating GMOs if given a choice. Health-conscious shoppers, it's overwhelming. So we know where they go to school, we know where they eat, we know what they read. So we have commitments from magazines to run as a two-page spread version of our shopping guide in their magazines for free. We have major websites. We have listservs with millions of people ready to send out our shopping guide in the next few weeks. We are going to give health-conscious shoppers what they have wanted for 12 years, clear non-GMO choices. And on top of that, the good news is the entire natural food industry is finally getting behind a new non-GMO standard, just like an organic standard. This is a third-party verified non-GMO standard. And on the board of that standard are the leaders of the natural food industry: Whole Foods, United Natural Foods, Nature's Path, Organic Valley, White Wave, Lundberg Family Farms. And they're converting their products to verified non-GMO, and the seals and the verification seals will be issued in a year. So we are, yes, let's give applause there. So we're giving them information, we're giving health-conscious shoppers information, we're giving ample supply of non-GM, and we're giving them choice. Health professionals, I'll read a quote from John Boyles, an MD. I used to test for soy allergies all the time, but now that soy is genetically engineered, it is so dangerous that I tell people never to eat it, unless it says organic. When Kellogg's realizes that doctors are prescribing to parents not to feed their kids Kellogg's cornflakes because it's GMO, when the food companies realize that doctors are prescribing non-GM diets, it's over. School meals and the parents associated with the schools. School meals are under intense scrutiny because of the incredible epidemic going on with our kids. So they have changes going on. They're making changes. They're in the process of making changes. Now is the perfect time to get them our information so that GMOs are added to the do not eat category. So we have a grassroots program with a 60-page manual and a video called Hidden Dangers in Kids' Meals. It's like instant activism. Just add DVD and stir. You show it to a group and you say, how many people want to work on a GM-free school campaign? The hands go up, and we can create that in communities all over the country. Religious groups. Think about it. If the evangelical Christians, for example, believe that GMO meant God move over, it's over. Large religious groups do not actually have to circulate the non-GMO shopping guide. They just have to threaten to do so. And GMOs are taken out. So these are the four demographic groups that we are focusing on. And now I'm going to share with you the tools that we can use. I saw the number of hands go up in terms of who wants to work on this. So you're all recruited. All right? So here's the game plan. Here's what we got. We've got a ton of stuff on our website, responsibletechnology.org. You have a PowerPoint presentation there, fully scripted. All these points, but aren't these beautiful PowerPoints? My wife did these. She's here. Let's give her a hand. Where are you? I don't see her, but oh yeah, there she is. So we have a PowerPoint fully scripted on our site. We have the Hidden Dangers in Kids' Meals video. We have a movie on called Your Milk on Drugs, Just Say No. Things for Doctors. We have about 40 articles that you can take and put on your own website and distribute. We have a monthly e-newsletter. Now, I got to tell you about this new video. I got a call a few years ago from a woman in France who turned out, I didn't know it, she was an award-winning author and filmmaker. And she was doing a film on Monsanto. And I had, I think by that time, 13 film crews come to my little town in Iowa. And I've been interviewed a dozen or two times elsewhere. And so I was very comfortable talking to filmmakers and giving them the whole background about who to interview and what the angles were. She knew it all. And she was traveling all over the world to people I had written about. She had gone over my book meticulously and written notes and gotten and followed through with each of these people. So she was incredibly well informed. So I knew that her film was going to be a blockbuster. So when I was in Europe, I went to Paris and looked at the early versions of the film and worked for a year to get distribution rights of the film. And it's now out. It's called The World According to Monsanto. How many people have seen it? It is so devastating. The 30 minutes after seeing this film are like the most motivated someone is in their life to stop GMOs. So we have a program for retail stores in the natural food industry. They put up the non-GMO education centers. They distribute the non-GMO shopping guides. They host free public showings of The World According to Monsanto. We have publicity materials downloadable on our website. You can do this too. We have handouts that can convert that energy into effective community action. But if you show this alone and you don't have any discussion afterwards, it can be very depressing. We have a 3-minute video in here called What We Can Do. It introduces the campaign for healthier eating in America. It introduces the tipping point. I gave a talk in Kansas City 2 weeks ago. And they had shown The World According to Monsanto 2 weeks before that. And they didn't have any discussion about activism. They didn't convert the energy. They didn't run the 3-minute video. And someone came up to me before the thing and burst into tears and said, "Is there any hope?" And I said, "Oh yes, there's hope. You just watch." So it is a powerful tool, and it can be used to create energy, and it can be done in house parties or public showings. And it came out perfectly in time for the campaign. This is what I want to talk to you about. This is a book. I was wandering around the world giving Seeds of Deception away to senior political leaders. And, you know, when I handed this thick book to the politicians, I realized they're never going to read it. They hardly do. In Vermont, we got lucky. But I realized I've embedded the information about the health dangers into stories about scientists that were fired, about regulatory agencies that were hijacked, about scientists that were threatened. And I realized that it's not the book I needed to give to politicians. They need brochures. Maybe less. But if they give it to their staff, the staff and the scientists, they need textbooks. So I had an idea. The idea was to do a two-page spread. And this side, the executive summary, is for the attention deficit politician. And this side is for their staff. And this side is for the patient, this side's for the doctor. This side's for, it's basically 65 health risks of GMOs, irrefutable, overwhelming evidence of harm. And when I give this to presidents and cabinet ministers and politicians around the world, I say, use this as a checklist. There are 65 health risks. Demand from the biotech industry that they counter each of those risks with rigorous independent data. If they can, I have no health argument. But if they can't, they have no justification for putting the foods on the market. And I have a place on my website with all of the left pages, and I say, please, respond, challenge. And I describe in the book, please, biotech industry, respond, challenge. But I also say, they won't. Because they lose the argument on the level of details and science. So what they do is they dismiss, they attack, but they don't debate. And in addition to these 65 risks, I realize, let's say I give it to a senator, and he says, well, I'm sure that the Food and Drug Administration is on top of this. I had to write, yeah, I know, it's a joke. I had to write part two, which shows how the current safety assessments by governments around the world are incompetent to even identify most of the risks. And part three, how industry-funded studies are designed to avoid finding the risks. And part four, why GMOs are not designed to feed the world. Their average one reduces yield. It's the worst possible thing. It takes money away from more appropriate technologies, and it causes things like suicides, etc. So this is for the left brain and the medical doctor and the school superintendent who needs to get convinced. So we've got a lot of different packaged materials that we've put together, and we are ready. We are really ready for this campaign. I've been working for 12 years. Please don't wait. Please take this message. We don't have the time, the luxury of the time, while they're polluting our gene pool, while they're introducing new products, while they're possibly colonizing our gut bacteria. We don't have time. But we have tremendous power. We just have to share these main points. Give people a choice. We just got this shopping guide a few weeks ago, and I've been carrying it around in my pocket, giving it to taxi drivers and waiters and people I meet in the airport. They are so excited. 9 out of 10 Americans want GMOs labeled. More than half would avoid them if they were labeled. We're not the minority. In this case, we're not unique. In this case, we're not weird. Think about it. We're not weird. That sounds kind of strange. But as far as being against GMOs, we are the vast majority. So let's make it happen. Let's make 2009 the year of ending the genetic engineering of our food supply. Thank you very much.
Visit the Institute for Responsible Technology online at responsibletechnology.org to get your own non-GMO shopping guide and to help get GMOs out of our food.